In 2008, something remarkable happened that few people noticed amid the historic celebration. Black women voted at higher rates than any other group in America. This wasn't an accident or a sudden awakening. It was the crescendo of a 200-year symphony of resistance, organizing, and unrelenting determination. While the nation celebrated its first black president, the women who made his election possible remained largely invisible, just as they had been throughout American history. Their story isn't a footnote to the civil rights movement or women's suffrage. It's the story of how democracy itself was expanded, redefined, and fought for by those who had the most to lose and the least to gain from staying silent. Picture Nancy Bell Graves, born into slavery in 1808 Kentucky. She couldn't vote, couldn't own property, couldn't even claim her own children. Yet her descendants would reshape American politics through four generations of strategic vision that would take more than a century to fully unfold. Nancy Bell Graves couldn't vote, own property, or claim her children. Yet her descendants reshaped American politics by refusing to accept that power only flows through ballot boxes. Her daughter, Susan Davis, created networks of black women's clubs across the nation, grassroots organizing decades before the term existed. When Missouri granted women the vote in 1919, granddaughter Fannie Williams immediately organized literacy classes to help black women navigate registration tests designed to block them. On Election Day 1920, her appearance at the polls was both personal victory and political statement. Great-granddaughter Susie Jones co-founded Bennett College, an institution for black women's leadership that would nurture civil rights activists. Four generations, each building on the last, each understanding that political power isn't just about voting. It's about institutions, education, economic independence, and collective action. This wasn't survival. It was strategic vision. When Jerina Lee heard a voice commanding her to go preach the gospel in the early 1800s, she faced a world that believed women who spoke publicly would lose all respectability. Church leaders and society told her no. She went anyway, traveling thousands of miles for 30 years, delivering sermons that challenged religious and gender hierarchies. When critics questioned her authority, she responded, "Did not Mary, a woman, preach the gospel?" Maria Miller Stewart took this defiance further. After her husband's death left her destitute, his estate stripped by legal maneuvering, Stewart channeled her rage into political activism. "O ye daughters of Africa, awake," she thundered before mixed audiences, becoming the first American woman to lecture publicly on politics. She demanded, "How long shall the fair daughters of Africa be compelled to bury their minds and talents beneath a load of iron pots and kettles?" The backlash was brutal. By 1833, Stewart was driven from the podium. But something had shifted. She had proven it could be done. 20 years later, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper would stand in the same Boston meeting house to cheers. Black women faced an impossible demand during the abolitionist and suffrage movements. Choose between fighting racism or sexism. White women wanted them to prioritize gender. Black men wanted them to prioritize race. Black women refused. They understood something that wouldn't have a name for another century: intersectionality. Their oppression wasn't additive, it was multiplicative. When Susan Paul organized her anti-slavery choir in Boston, she faced racism from white abolitionists and sexism from black men. In 1838, when a mob burned Pennsylvania Hall rather than allow black and white women to meet together, the message was clear. Black women's political participation was so threatening that violence was justified to stop it. By the 1850s, this tension exploded at women's rights conventions. When white suffragists called black women's concerns a distraction, Sojourner Truth responded with devastating clarity. Standing 6 feet tall, she reframed everything. "I am a woman's rights." She had labored in fields, born children, endured slavery, and if that didn't make her equal to any man, what did? The Civil War promised transformation, but delivered betrayal. When Frances Ellen Watkins Harper addressed white suffragists in 1866, she confronted their narrow focus on property rights with her reality of being thrown off streetcars while white women watched silently. "You white women speak of rights," she declared. "I speak of wrongs." Black women became essential to the war effort. Harriet Tubman worked as nurse, spy, and scout for the Union Army, without salary or pension. Susie King Taylor taught soldiers and freed people to read, unpaid and unrecognized. Mary Ann Shad Carey became a Union recruiter. These women didn't just support the war, they were the war effort in many communities. Reconstruction brought hope. Three constitutional amendments promised to remake America. Black men gained the vote. Surely black women would be next. But when the suffrage movement split in 1869, white suffragists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton argued that educated white women deserved the vote more than ignorant black men. Black women found themselves abandoned by white women who chose gender over racial justice and by black men who opposed women's suffrage. So they built their own movement. When Anna Julia Cooper declared, "Only the black woman can say when and where I enter," she claimed the revolutionary right to self-determination. During Reconstruction, black women shaped politics without voting, attending meetings, making decisions, and monitoring polls for intimidation. When Josephine DeQuere was denied a ladies' stateroom in 1872, she sued to test black women's constitutional rights. The Supreme Court said no. So black women turned to the church. Amanda Berry Smith became a powerful evangelist, preaching across denominational and racial lines in England, India, and Africa. By the 1890s, they'd created a national movement. The National Association of Colored Women, founded in 1895, united hundreds of local clubs under Lifting as We Climb, political organizing disguised as community service, building power when direct participation was denied. August 1920, the 19th Amendment passes. Women have the vote, except not really. Throughout the South, black women faced literacy tests, poll taxes, and violence. Georgia closed registration entirely. White suffragists walked away. When black leaders asked Alice Paul's National Women's Party for help, Paul refused and declared victory. Black women's voting rights weren't part of women's suffrage. But black women didn't quit. They organized suffrage schools through churches, studying constitutions, and practicing for registration tests. In Richmond, Maggie Lena Walker, the first black woman bank president, confronted a registrar trying to close while 100 black women waited in line. From Nancy Bell Graves in 1808 to Fannie Lou Hamer in 1964, black women spent 150 years fighting for rights others took for granted. They built institutions when doors closed and developed political philosophies recognizing interconnected oppressions long before intersectionality became academic. Today, black women vote at higher rates than any demographic, honoring a legacy and completing their great-great-grandmother's journey. They prove democracy isn't given, but taken, built, and defended. The vanguard still leads, insisting freedom means freedom for everyone. Their revolution isn't finished.